Hope you're doing okay. Been up all night here into the early morning hours, finishing up the video upload on the developments in Syria. And before we kick off the show, I just wanted to give you just a quick update. You know, things change so incredibly fast. So I just want to let you know that this show was recorded Thursday afternoon, literally just hours before Trump issued an airstrike on Syria. So some of the questions brought up in this show that you're about to listen to, those questions we've now gotten answers to. We've in fact gotten loud and clear answers to them. So definitely check out our latest video, Trump Train Derailed, Sells Out to Neocon Globalists and Attacks Syria, for more information on how this has unfolded and the lies behind it. But this show with Kevin McDonald is still a great prescient analysis of the situation. We just know a few more things now, that's all. So definitely stay tuned. Good show ahead. Thank you for listening, guys. Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for tuning in. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, redice.tv and redicemembers.com. That's the main websites. Welcome back to everyone. It's great to have you here. So we're connecting again with Kevin McDonald today, having him back on the show to discuss about some of the latest developments, both when it comes to what's happening right now in Syria with the Trump administration, their reactions to this, and a whole lot more. So it's great to have you back on the show again, Kevin. Thank you for coming on.
It's always great to be here with you, Henrik.
So what's your take on what's happening in Syria right now? I mean, this is very volatile. Trump had a position previously where basically he had a much more calm stance, if you will. He had been tweeting about the fact that, you know, we got to assess the situation in Syria. We have to, you know, kind of work with Assad. He even seemed skeptical to some of the neocon positions when he came to Syria and this treatment. Now, for some reason, I don't know what's driving this or what the reasons are. We can speculate about this, but it seems to have changed his tone, and he seems to go along, unfortunately, with the mainstream narrative. How do you decode the situation of why Trump is kind of a turncoat all of a sudden on this situation?
Well, really, I'm incredulous and extremely disappointed. I feel betrayed. As you say, throughout the campaign, he made statements that he was opposed to any kind of intervention overseas. He didn't like the idea of creating democracy and so on. But here we go again. And he even said, recently, and I was really happy to see this, that he was going to, that toppling Assad was not going to be a priority anymore. I mean, that's great. That's exactly what we want. And then this happens, this gassing attack happens, and he jumps to the conclusion that it's Assad on the basis of no evidence. And all of a sudden, you know, we're threatening intervention. Assad is evil. I mean, it's like total deja vu when you think about Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. You know, the whole propaganda thing that these were evil people. We have to take care of them. We have to do regime change and all that. It's just absolutely maddening that this is going on now.
Yeah, do you remember the the Iraq war? This goes way back, of course, but I remember the story when George W. Bush, not the son, but the dad was in office, and they were trying to pitch this false story of babies in incubators, right? They'd thrown out babies and put them on the floor, and there was actually a daughter of, I think, the ambassador to Kuwait, I believe it was, that was doing, she was in Congress or something like that, testifying to these things, and it was found out later that she was basically just concocting this story to get the U.S. riled up and involved in the first Iraq war. Remember that story?
Yeah, I do remember that. And that's so typical. And when a story like that comes out, the mainstream media just runs with it. You know, this is the truth here. We are such suckers for these arguments. I mean, with these moral arguments that, you know, Saddam is bad, Gaddafi's bad, Assad is bad, Hitler is bad. Going back to World War One, it was always that way. So moral arguments are always being used. And quite often these atrocities have been invented. I mean, they're simply part of propaganda and self-interested kind of things and a part of the mainstream media.
You know, the question is, what is the proof anyway, right? Because unfortunately, we're at a position where we just have to rely on the information that we're given. Of course, we can decode what we're given. We can look at the footage, we can see the pictures, and we can, you know, analyze them and say, is this credible? Is it true? What's really happening here? Because what I've seen already is footage coming out where supposed victims have, you know, while they're lying on the ground, they're opening their eyes, these little kids. There's people that are walking around supposedly cleaning off some of these victims of a sarin gas attack without gloves on or anything, which is, I mean, you can't do that. You would basically die yourself if you're, you know, if you're contaminated by this gas. So it doesn't look very promising for them, does it?
No, I've seen those videos and some of the photos. I mean, it is outrageous. If you tell this to, you know, the mainstream media, they'll say, oh, that's not, you can't believe that. But it is amazing. Right? These people have, absolute certainty that it was a sign. What is the evidence? I mean, I was reading Jonathan Tobin yesterday. He's a neocon, you know, writes in National Review and commentary and so on. And it's like, this is just well known. Everybody knows this. McCain, they all do that. Without any evidence. And you know, as we all know, in the Iraq War, when they were, you know, pushing that, there were all these media statements about, you know, Saddam was all cruel to his people, and who knows what the real truth was. And, you know, you can see what the effects of that were in the long term. Here we are, you know, 14 years later, and Iraq's a mess, completely unstable, terrorism going on. Same in Libya, disastrous situation, or you should simply unleash tribal warfare. The same in Iraq. It'll be the same in Syria. It's insane, but these people have an agenda and they want to get rid of those regimes. And I think Iran is probably next in their sights.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when it comes to the Iraq war, very high casualty rates in the millions, unfortunately. Many among those are innocent women and children.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, they have this immense double standard where now all of a sudden these children matter, right? Now in Syria, they matter because now they can be used as these, you know, poster boys, kind of like Alan Kurdi was in Europe to rectify basically the ongoing refugee invasion, right? These are the emotional blackmail. That's what this is about, to get support riled up, to get people to go along with basically an invention, more of the same. Yeah, haven't people learned about this yet? You know,
it's just amazing. In the Syrian civil war, between 320 and 400,000 people have died, and all of a sudden we're absolutely, you know, completely outraged at 25 children or whatever, 7,500 people who were killed in this attack. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, why not try to end the war? End the war. And the Assad government is not going away. For one thing, they are going to fight to the death because they are a particular ethnic group, and they, the Alawites, and they know that if they lose, they're going to be exterminated. That is, these Muslims have said that. So this is absolutely insane that we keep, you know, propping up the idea that somehow Assad has to go. And there's no question that there's a big Israeli influence on this. You know, all the papers in Israel, the Israeli media, were immediately blaming Assad. They're absolutely certain. Israeli intelligence says it's certain. What evidence is there? There's no evidence that anybody's come up with, that this was Assad. And why would he do this right after Trump says, basically, you've got a free pass now. We're not going to try to interfere with you. Why would you do this outrageous, outrageous thing that is going to absolutely inflame the Western media and was actually the pretext for the invade, for what Obama did in 2013? You know, why would you do that? It is absolutely crazy. So you got to believe the default position here has to be Assad did not do it. It's totally against his interest. Why would you kill 100 people, 25 children, infuriate the entire Western world via the media and make them and make it virtually, you know, very difficult for you to win this thing? It's just insane.
Yeah, the timing is just too perfect, you know, and that's the giveaway. And as you say, I mean, if he did this to his own people, right, this would basically be the go ahead that they would need to justify even further intervention and removal of him. I mean, it's have you actually heard anything yet of what I noticed with the Western media, with the fake news outlets, the mainstream lying media out there, is that they don't go to the sources and actually try to get a comment from you know, in this case, Assad himself, right? What's his response to this? It's just a big wall, and we don't hear anything. No news is coming out from Syria. We don't even know what the conversation is like there. It's just, you know, we take our own word for it. This is what happened. He did it. We're certain now. Let's invade, right? It's absolutely miraculous that they can get away with this and doing it this way without even hearing what Assad himself is saying.
Fortunately, Putin's media has come out and said, or his government said, that it was a result of, I think, an airstrike on a munitions, warehouse or something like that. And with these rebels were storing this stuff, and then it blew up. So this was not intentional. On the part of whoever, you know, dropped those bombs or whatever. They didn't intend to have a gas attack, if that is true. But that, you know, you're not even going to get any hearing for that among these neocons and the mainstream media in this country. And I just gotta hope that Trump is going to come to his senses on this.
Yeah, let's get into that in a little bit here in terms of why this would be, right? What do they have something on Trump? Is he being blackmailed? Who knows what kind of briefing he's been through? We'll talk about that too, and also why it would be in Israel's interest to remove Assad. So that's coming a little bit later. But let's talk about McCain a little bit first and discuss, because he was, of course, famously meeting with these so-called moderate rebels. There was actually news coming out a couple of years ago where they said that all the chemical weapons that had been found in Syria had basically been taken out of the country, and they had been destroyed in some capacity or another. So basically, apparently the report was there is no anymore in the territory. Assad doesn't have access to any of these weapons anymore. But here we are. I wouldn't be surprised if it's McCain and his cohorts that have actually supplied the so-called moderate rebels, which basically is just Al-Qaeda, ISIS, right, with these kinds of weapons. So they have it stockpiled somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, they got it from somewhere. And it's totally plausible to me that these rebels would do this, because there have been, you know, documented attacks by the rebels using gas. So I don't have any problem with that. But I feel Trump, you know, maybe deciding that he can't govern without these neocons. You know, he's actually kept these neocons out of the foreign policy establishment, which I definitely applaud. He didn't have people like Elliot Abrams in there. They were talking about John Bolton, all these people that are totally associated with the neocons. And people like, you know, and the same mindset as McCain, where there's never a war that you don't like. I worry that he's deciding that, you know, maybe he has to play ball more with the Republican establishment. And that would be a disaster, because the Republican establishment, you know, is very neoconish. And then you got people like Paul Ryan with their crazy healthcare stuff. You know, if they do that, they're just going to get wiped out in 2018 and 2020. I think he's got to pursue his populist program. You know, what he said. He's got to have a healthcare system that works for his base, the white working class that voted him in. And if he doesn't come up with that, they're not going to vote for him the next time, especially after he's gone back on all these other things, like his foreign policy statement. So we'll see. But I don't know I really don't know what's going on. You know, you see all these reports now about, you know, infighting within the White House. You know, Jared Kushner against Steve Bannon. Yeah. And all that. And you worry. I mean, Steve Bannon was our hero, kind of. He was our guy in the White House. And there's some reports that he's losing influence. I worry about that. It's not clear. There's, you know, contradictory things out there. But I'm concerned about that Trump is suddenly going to, sort of push out Bannon a little bit and de-emphasize him. He was taken off the National Security Council. That in itself might not be a big deal, but there may be other things. I mean, Bannon may have screwed up with the healthcare thing. He was being very authoritarian there, talking the way he talked to Congress. But, we got to hope that Bannon retains some influence on our key issues, like immigration. I just don't know. But, it's a little opaque right now. What's going on in the White House? And I worry that Jared Kushner really is a neocon at heart.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very pro-Israel, pro-settlements, right-wing Israeli. Well, that's exactly what the neocons support. And I wouldn't be surprised if he, has their foreign policy views as well and, wants to take out Assad just like the rest of the Israeli establishment. I worry about all that. So I just don't know, though, at this point.
Yeah, I think Jared Kushner, he's in Iraq right now again, so the timing is pretty convenient on this. And, right. What do you think is going on? Do you think that there's any, obviously there's clear internal strifes here. Something is happening behind the scenes, which we are not privy to, I think. I mean, right. ever since Flynn was removed, things have been shaken up quite, in an extraordinary way. And I think it's the old guard, as you said, the old Republican neocon guard. It's basically more or less have been pushed out when Trump got into office. He managed to get many of his own people in there that he liked. We did, of course, have some people from the old guard, if you will, some of the Mnuchins and the Cohns from Goldman Sachs and these kinds of people. Nonetheless, many of them were under Trump's umbrella of ideas, if you will. Now it looks like through a couple of different crises, they are trying to basically remove all the most, in their view, dangerous elements from within the Trump administration and get their own people in place. And they're using this, just as Rahm Emanuel said, never let a disaster go to waste. And somehow they are managing to oust some of these people. Now, what do you think is going on there? Do they have something on Trump? Is it blackmail? What do you think would allow him to go along with this? He has been so strong on his own position for the longest time. Why would he buckle all of a sudden?
Yeah, it's possible they have something on him. But I think the other thing is that he is a populist. He comes in, he's not one of these traditional Republicans. He's not like, say, Romney would have come in there. And he pointed a lot of neocons, foreign policy, sort of conservative people to the other cabinet positions and so on. But Trump is actually not appointed that many, they haven't filled that many positions because, this was a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, really. And there's just a lot of positions in the government that have to be filled. And I don't think, he's able to find enough people that are really on board. And maybe he's just saying, well, you got to just play this game. I really worry he's going to be just like any other Republican president. And, it's that would just be so disheartening.
Yeah.
But it does, these neocons have established, they have made the foreign policy establishment for the Republican Party. It's very hard, to find people who know something about foreign policy. It would be a sort of reasonable appointment to those positions who are not neocons. I mean, I think that was the problem when George Bush came in. That really the only people, and Cheney was linked into all these Jewish neocons. And so they naturally gravitated to that, and they picked people who were sort of the sort of shadow government of that the neocons had in place already, Trump didn't do that, but it could be that he's feeling that he just can't get anywhere. I just don't know, because if he goes after Syria the way the neocons want. And then it'll be Iran. I mean, that is completely betraying everything he said in the campaign.
Yeah.
And it's just absolutely horrible if he does that.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, is okay, was it an act? What was it? I mean, they took a massive gamble with someone like Trump. If that's what they would try to pull off, and I'm not suggesting that, but it does make you wonder. It's easy to go down the conspiratorial route here, considering everything that's happening, that somehow they try to get a guy in there who would be changing things, and then eventually, you know, he follows up on the same way. Doesn't mean, of course, a lot of other things. We could talk about that later. What he still is able to achieve with the business, the recovery of the economy, the infrastructure planning, yeah, the wall, stuff like that. We can discuss that later. But in this particular case, when it comes to the foreign policy, it's at this point close to 180. And I wonder what happened in some of those briefing meetings, if you will, where the generals or whoever might be in, have been briefing Trump and said, you know, sir, we've gotten intel. It's just a chemical attack in Syria. You have to make a statement about that now. You would hope that he would be in a position where, like, I don't know, but, you know, I have to look at this evidence. What is it? What intel do we have available? Let's question it, right? But he seems to just go along with it right now, which is so frustrating, right?
Very frustrating. And I agree. I mean, it surprised me. The first thing that surprised me about this is that Trump goes on right after this attack and says Assad did it, you know, and he's evil. And, you know, without any real evidence, and not even saying that he got this report from his intelligence, and not saying, you know, all of our intelligence says this, and this is what happened. He didn't even do that. He just sort of jumped to this conclusion. And I thought that, you know, as a businessman, as someone who's been around the block a few times, you don't just take a word for that. This is obviously the sort of thing that is the very stuff of propaganda. I mean, every war has had this. And that's, you have to be skeptical about these things until you see exactly what is going on. And it's really well, you know, verified videos, reliable eyewitnesses and so on, people that don't have an axe to grind. I mean, it's amazing. They talk to the rebels over there.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't even care what Assad said. But actually, I heard that on the InfoWars, they were saying that some of the rebels acknowledged that it was an explosion in their warehouse, that they didn't know what they were doing, handling the gas or something like that. Anyway,
it might have just actually been an accident because they're kind of moronic, but then they decided to use that as a, you know, to pin it on Assad and say, okay, never let a crisis go to waste. Let's use it and then let's, you know, see what comes out of it. The other thing I heard, though, Kevin, was that I don't know how they know this. This is also kind of rumors, if you will, but apparently there was almost an exact amount of number of people that had been kidnapped by Al-Qaeda just a few days earlier, I guess over the course of a couple of days or something like that, around, I don't know if it was 240 or maybe it was 140, I forget the exact number now. And then conveniently, that's kind of the number that was reported on later that was victims of this attack. I mean, I saw, it's funny in a way, but I saw a couple of years ago, it was a video coming out from Iraq about a car bomb. I don't know if you saw that. It literally shows one guy jumping into a dilapidated car that's just standing on the side, getting out from it, jumping into another good car, driving away, far, far away. Then there's no one in sight. The bomb goes off. And then after the fact that the bomb has gone off, then a number of people run into the frame, if you will, of the shot, lays down, starts playing like they've been hurt from this car bomb, and the cameras come out and never starts filming it. I mean, you see stuff like that coming. Yeah, you see stuff like that coming out, and you're just like, how can we believe this? I mean, when we see photos of these people or like that little boy in the ambulance that the white helmets depicted, you know, as a victim also of Assad just bombing civilians and things like this. This could just be a setup for the Western media who just swallowed this hook, line, and sinker, you know?
Exactly. I think our default position in any of these reports of atrocities has got to be skepticism. You know, show me the evidence. You make it really clear, you know, reliable, because otherwise, you know, this is the stuff of propaganda. This is exactly how it works. And of course, the mainstream media jumped on it. And all the neocons just assumed, just stated as fact, we know this. It's just absolutely...
It's frustrating. It's so frustrating. You know, I want to ask you about this too a little bit with the false flag attacks and these kinds of claims, because... I recognize that they happen, but I'm also not want to jump to the fact that everyone is, and someone listening might even be let's say, thinking that we are hypocritical because we're looking at this as a staged thing when we're not looking at something like, let's say, the very recent London attacks. At least I'm not. I think that was real. I think that that happened, etc. And I know the other people have other ideas about that. But I think the giveaway is, Kevin, and I want to get your take on this, it's how the situation is being used. That's the giveaway, whether it's propaganda or not. Because in this case, you know, an incident has happened in Syria. There's people probably, we don't know, but they're probably hurt or they could have been dead or something. We don't know. Something has happened. But it's being used as a legitimization for invasion of Syria and the removal of Assad, right? And that's the giveaway. When it comes to London, for example, you don't hear other countries around the world, or even the UN, as they, I mean, the UN spoke out in this case and said, we are considering actions in Syria just to stop this kind of stuff. You don't hear an organization like the UN saying, we're going to come into England and make sure that this migration wave or the radicalization is stopped, right? They don't. No, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. It's like they don't jump on this opportunity as a way to try to radically change policy or change the government structure. Hence, that's a giveaway that it's probably not a false flag because the establishment isn't using it in that way, right?
Right. Exactly. It's really what the media does with it, what the establishment politicians do with it. And we've heard this story before, haven't we? I mean, as we said before, you know, in Iraq, you know, we had all these atrocities, you know, that it wasn't just the weapons of mass destruction. It was Saddam was, you know, massacring his own people. He just has to go. It's like it's our mission in the world to remove all evil, you know, and as if, you know, that really is required, as if that helps at all. You're just going to replace it with another regime that you know, has the same kinds of problems. That's all of our experience. I mean, if you look at Libya, look at Iraq, it's just not going to change. And so we have to get more sophisticated at this, but people are just such suckers. They see a kid, you know, as you say, some of these photos of these refugees who have had, or the kids in Syria who have been, you know, wounded by this or killed, and heart goes out. It's the same with migration, of course.
Yeah.
You see a Syrian child washed up on the beach in Turkey, and immediately Europe has to open up its doors to every migrant who wants to get there. It's because we can't ignore the suffering here.
They ignored the suffering of that little girl who died in Nice, the French girl, for example, right?
Exactly. They ignored that completely. But you know, this is another theme that I emphasize a lot, that Western peoples especially are prone to these moral arguments. I mean, we see this now with you know, Trump's stuff on immigration. You'll see all these sob stories, families pulled apart. You know, and people just go for that. You know, they don't think of the long-term interest. They don't think of the interests of the workers that are being displaced, the wages that are going down. They don't think about the conflict and everything that results from all this. You know, it's just, they're just putting up a picture there, and you have to react to their suffering. So the immigration, but you think about every one of our wars going back to the Civil War, really fought on the basis of some kind of moral imperative. We have to, you know, in the First World War, we have to make the world safe for democracy. We have to, you know, the same thing has happened over and over and over again. We have to stop being so emotionally empathic. So many of our people are. It's a weakness.
Yeah.
And especially women, they just go crazy. When there's some kind of disaster, like in Haiti, like an earthquake, all these people want to adopt Asian children and so on. You know, and it's always white people. It's always, it's just very sad.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. Let's definitely return to that a bit later. One of the things I want to ask you about, which I think we should clarify a bit to the audience as well, Kevin, is why is it so important for the neocons to remove Assad? Is it simply that he's just not playing ball with them? He's doing things which is counterproductive, because it seems, just as you alluded to before, that when the establishment and the neocons have gotten their way, like they did in Iraq, like they did in Libya, those zones have been descending into chaos. The power vacuum has opened up. This led to, among other things, not only radicalization and these extreme factions of extremist Islam to kind of formulate, but also to the refugee crisis and in the invasion. Is it simply that they want to have more of the same, or is it the territory which is in close proximity to Israel, for example, that's being looked at as a threat and that needs to be kind of neutralized? Wouldn't that, though, I mean, if they did remove Assad, which seemingly has been able to hold the peace better than, you know, other leaders have, wouldn't that be a liability to Israel? That would be developing into even a more of a dangerous region, right?
Yeah, Israeli foreign policy in that region has been to destabilize these regimes. These Arab societies are very fractionated. You know, they're tribal societies. The vast majority are Muslim, but they're tribal, and so they're very fragile. And so but the only way to govern them are the way Saddam Hussein did. And the way Assad did, you can't have a democracy. It's just an absolute delusion to think these people are going to become good Republicans or Democrats, the Colonist Club, and all this stuff. It's not going to happen. So they understood that about these Arab societies, and they have systematically tried to destabilize it. And of course, the neocons are serving Israeli interests. A lot of these neocons have been on Israeli think tanks and so on. They promoted the Iraq War. So they, from their point of view, they see this as good for Israel, because you don't want strong regimes. If anything, I mean, it's pretty obvious that they got their way in Iraq. It was totally win-win for Israel. You destroyed Saddam Hussein, so what do you got there now? It's a weakened regime. It's prone to terror. There's all this, fighting between different groups. Nobody's happy. So that's when they're foreign policy. But the other thing is that Syria is linked with Iran. So now, in a way, it was really crazy for us to go into Iraq if the neocons in Israel thought that would be good for them, because what that did is make Iraq more under the influence of Iran, because they're right next door. And now you've got a Shiite majority in Iraq, just like Iran. And you've got this, and basically Iran is now dominating the Shiite alliance that goes from Iran, into Syria and Iraq. So the point is that they see this as a real problem. If you took out Assad and installed some other government that was not pro-Iran, that was not anti-Israel, well, that's obviously good for them. So that has been a big issue. Well, one of the things I tweeted today was this WikiLeaks email from Hillary Clinton saying, that the real interest, the big interest here in going after Assad is to promote Israeli foreign policy. I mean, so they understood that. They understand that. But I think you're supposed to be pretty rational here. They want to get rid of an ally of Iran. Ultimately, they want to take down Iran. But, even if the Syrian civil war ended tomorrow, they have been put back for decades. I mean, you think about all the destruction there.
Yeah.
The economy must have gone to hell. I mean, it's just a disaster for them, but it's good for Israel. It's a win-win. And they surely don't care if that unleashes migration into Europe.
They might in fact favor that on some level. I mean, if they could effectively not only like depopulate some of these areas, but even making sure that maybe even some of the more radical elements go to Europe and try to make jihad or something there, it would actually secure the region for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They see things if a group comes up like ISIS and they're horrible and terrible and they do all these terrible things. But they don't evaluate it that way, some kind of moral way. They see, well, there's against Assad, that's just fine. In fact, Israel has provided ISIS with medical support, probably weapons, maybe advice and so on. And they've been pretty close to ISIS. So, you know, they understand the region very well, and they're pursuing their interests quite effectively.
Yeah, it seems that Israel might even be in a position where they actually thrive on instability in some of the other regions, because it means they can't organize, they can't team up, they can't start working together or build up their, you know, defense and arsenal and all this kind of stuff. So just, I mean, they get ahead by keeping these other countries that is in proximity in a weakened state, and hence they will never be able to get ahead. And again, I think it serves that double purpose of, like, you can actually drive, you know, refugees into Europe. And again, who knows how they are going to seek to use that in the future when a European population, and maybe even an American one, is increasingly fed up with, you know, Muslim radical attacks, you know, in the West and stuff like this. That might even justify not us taking care of the problem in our own countries, but it might actually justify military intervention in the Middle East. So you will have, yeah, who knows, you might even have European armed forces at some point going into Middle Eastern countries, almost like a resurgence of some crusade, you know, period or something, right?
Had to be something, yeah. See, I don't know, you know, it's like, but yeah, this unleashed this invasion of Europe. It's increased it. I mean, it was going on anyway. In a way, I've sometimes thought, well, maybe it's good because it's waking Europeans up. You know, before that, it was a trickle. People don't notice it that much. But now, you know, and with the connection with ISIS and everything, all the terrorism, you can't not notice it. If you're in France, you know, Germany, UK, and so on, it's there. And so this Islamic invasion, by the way, it oftentimes these people hate Jews. You know, they're Muslim. A lot of them. You know, just, you know, there's been a lot of anti-Jewish activity in Europe because of that. But so far, all the mainstream Jewish organizations want more refugees, more migrants. And I think they feel they can manage this. And if, you know, some Jews decide to leave for Israel or something, well, so what? That's the way they're going to do it.
Yeah, exactly. But in a way, then, that's an interesting take on it, too, that an increasing pressure on European societies when it comes to migrants, radicalization of those elements within us, like we saw happen with the London attacker, he used his car and knives and stuff like that. It's absolutely horrible, obviously. I'm not saying anything else, but I'm saying it also helps to develop a sense of identity of people in Europe that has been, you know, isolated from those elements. And now all of a sudden they have a rivalry group. They have an antagonism from an external group that hates them for just being part of that group. When the European mind, most of people who are Europeans, they never even thought about these things before, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. And then despite the big media being on the side of migration and all that, pretty much unanimously, just like in America, all the polls show an increasing skepticism about these policies. We saw Brexit, you know, it's very actually disappointing what happened in Holland, you know, with Geert Wilders only getting 13% of the vote, because you'd think, but the polls do show concern about Muslim immigration and not wanting any more. But of course, the EU is just the opposite. This is an elite, and they're going to keep pushing this. These policies, but you know, we have to hope. Marine Le Pen is maybe hope that she could actually win. That would be something.
She might break the back on the EU finally.
Yeah, I worry. You know, maybe perhaps French voters are looking at Trump and saying, "This is not so good." I mean, I worry. There's so much chaos now, and with the foreign policy, and everything is the whole thing. The investigations and surveillance things, and the Russia collusion. You know. It's just out of control.
Yeah, there's so.
I've never seen anything like this in my life in politics, where there's just so much going on and such political intensity. And I mean, you got the Supreme Court appointment of Neil Gorsuch, another one that's completely polarizing. We are really entering times of absolute fracture here. I mean, where people can't talk to each other, where families can't talk to each other.
Right.
Some people have said this is like pre-Civil War talk. I mean, it's that kind of thing where people just can't see the points that the other people are making. They're just completely in a different universe. I mean, I sometimes, and I follow on Twitter, I follow some people on the left and look at that, what they post, and it's just amazing. It's like they don't even mention any of this stuff. They don't talk about these terrorist events. I mean, it didn't happen, and we can't be afraid of refugees or immigration. And this is right after the attack in London. They never mention it on their blogs, their Twitter feeds, and it's like only certain information goes, and the information they focus on are, well, you know, all these people are going to lose health insurance with Trump's plan, and Trump's still connected to his businesses, and he's, you know, got this nepotism going with his daughter and Kushner and la la la, and that's all they talk about, you know. And oh, yeah. I'm concerned about some of those things. I'm concerned about healthcare, but it's because I'm concerned that he's going to lose his base. But the people, they don't. It's like we're in different universes now, and you literally can't talk to the other person. You mention certain things, and they just dismiss you out of mind. You're a racist. You're evil, and they won't talk to you. They won't read anything. They won't look at evidence. It's just over with. That's where we're at now.
Yeah.
And they say that's a pre-Civil War kind of talk. We're at the point where, you know, people just don't want to even live in the same country.
No, the discussion is over. That's it. People have picked a side. Yeah, and now it's just, yep, now it's just the ramping up and the polarization. And add on top of that, the you know, these news, the fake news claims, and the way that there's cracking down on people basically sharing the kind of stories that we're talking about when it comes to Syria and countering information and stuff like that. Facebook has begun a incredible censoring program that was spearheaded by, I believe it was spearheaded in Germany. There were a potentiality of a lawsuit on Facebook from the German government, which I think was like a fine of like 500 million euros or something ridiculous like that. So they have started, you know, censoring basically people that share stories which are considered to be, quote, fake news, right? So you have a whole team of people that are sitting there and filtering and censoring and saying, no, this you can't read, this you can't share. I mean, it's absurd. It's like that certain information now has become, I guess, in their view, weaponized because it's breaking the narrative of the establishment. It's causing people to look in a different direction. And frankly, they are losing that battle. They are losing that debate. I think that we are winning the argument because we're talking about reality and the real kind of stuff that's happening in the world. And the only thing that they know how to do is to censor and block and shut down and de-platform people, right?
Right. I think the biggest fake news are actually sins of omission, things they don't report. And like you say, then if you put it on Facebook or something, then in Germany at least, or maybe probably the UK and elsewhere, you will get some of the police at you knocking on your door. But you know, things like when there's crimes, in a lot of places they won't mention anything about religion or ethnicity of the perpetrator, you know, because people sort of have this view now that these people are way overrepresented among criminals. The rape statistics. Sweden's become the rape capital of the world, I guess, and it's not because of native Swedes.
No.
So that's the kind of thing that's omitted routinely. And the Syrian thing, I mean, you know, again, if you look at these neocon things, and they are in the mainstream media, like Bret Stephens and the Wall Street Journal, they will not mention the possibility even that this could be, you know, false flag or an accident or anything. You know, it just couldn't, it doesn't get on the screen. So again, that they omit important things that's the virtue of the internet. But, you know, we all worry that in the long run, you know, they're going to clamp it all down like they try to do in Germany, and pretty successful. We'll see.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to take a break in just a few minutes, and then we're going to talk more in the second segment. We have much more to discuss. I want to ask you about the Russian collusion, you know, how the mainstream is dealing with this. Also getting into some of the things pertaining to, you know, World War One as well. We're coming up on the 100th year anniversary when America entered into the First World War. And, you know, and again, there's so many echoes of this in our current day and age of the fact that It's an increasing rhetoric. It's an increasing geopolitical pressure that we're living under right now. As Kevin said, it's just amazing how quickly many things are ramping up. Even North Korea, for Christ's sake, is like firing missile off of the coast outside of Japan. Yeah, it's crazy. It's off the wall in terms of everything that's happening. So we'll talk about that and much more when we return. But please, Kevin, before we take a break, tell us about the Occidental Observer, what some of the new things are on the site that people can read about, and also, of course, plug your books, The Culture of Critique, and some of the other titles that you have as well.
Yeah, the Occidental Observer, we had a paper, an article yesterday about the Syrian crisis by Colin Liddell talking about why it's probable that the Syrian gas attack is a fake, is a false flag, it's an accident or something. Basically along the lines that we talked about today. And we have an article on World War I. We can talk about that later. And I posted a lot of things. Some of from my research. I talk about Roman social organization and so on for a book I'm writing on Western origins and peoples. And as far as my books at Occidental, the Culture Critique is the one that people most resonate to, and that's about Jewish intellectual movements in the 20th century. And I'm actually gratified. I see a lot of people on Twitter saying how much it changed their lives.
Absolutely. It's magnificent work, Kevin. I can't plug it enough. It's just amazing. And there are some chapters, I think, sampled on your site that people can read, which are just excellent.
Yeah, if you read the Occidental Observer, I've linked to all the chapters sooner or later. But I only have certain up there. The main ones that I really think are critical, like the one on immigration, that is so critical. It's chapter 7, and I have a summary chapter, so you can really get a good feel of the book by reading that chapter 6. And that's the kind of thing that I have up there.
Yeah, exactly. Do get a copy, ladies and gentlemen, of The Culture of Critique. Kevin has other titles, too. We'll link to those. You can check those out. He has some excellent works there, of course. This is academic and scientific, and it proves some of these concepts, too, that we're talking about in a way that very few other authors make, So definitely make sure that you pick up copies of Kevin's work and support his work. And then, of course, also on top of that, I just want to mention, you have the Occidental, quarterly as well, coming out quarterly in the year. And how can people subscribe to that, Kevin?
Yeah, until we started talking here, I was working hard on the summer issue. The spring issue is out for subscribers online. It's out. The printed version will be mailed out soon. And you can go to toqonline.com and subscribe. And we, it's really important to subscribe because we want to be self-sufficient. It costs quite a bit to put out this print edition. But we're trying to be self-sufficient. We are supported by the Charles Martel Society to some extent. But that's really where we want to go. We want to maximize our subscription for that reason.
Absolutely. We'll have links up, ladies and gentlemen. Do check it out, the Occidental Quarterly. And also, of course, Kevin's books. We'll have links up to that. The Culture Critique is kind of the magnum opus, if you will, that Kevin has done. But we are going to continue with the second hour with Kevin MacDonald after the break. We'll pick this right up at redicemembers.com. If you're new to the show, that's the website for our subscribers. You get access to over 1,200 shows and counting. So do sign up for a membership with us. We have much more to discuss with Kevin as we go deeper into the geopolitical issues and also the long-term goal for that which is now outside of the interest and realm of regular Trumpism, so to speak. Before we go to break, I just want to let you know that Weekend Warrior, our live TV show, will be on Sunday the 9th this week, and this is due to recent developments and other videos being prioritized on the developing situation in Syria. We need an extra day for preparation. That's just how it goes. So thank you for understanding. And it is your membership that helps us to stay on schedule. And the more support and members that we have, the more editors, reporters, assistants, and everything else we can get onto the team and onto the show and help keep the show and the production on track without working ourselves to death. So help us grow. Help the Red Ice team grow. And keep us ad-free as well. So thank you for your support. Sign up for membership, and we'll be right back. Guys and gals, we'll talk to you on the other side.